Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be here with you. 2 hours of Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin this hour. But it's the internet version. All the questions have come to us via the internet. People ask Jimmy a lot of different things, the mundane to the wildly interesting, sometimes obscure, and often mysterious because of Jimmy Akin's mysterious world and Jimmy's reputation for taking all questions and taking them seriously. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's mysterious world. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Very hello, Cyril Kellett. How are you doing today?
Oh, very hello. I'm very well. Thank you very much. Jimmy Akin's mysterious world, maybe you should just, for the four people who listen who don't know what that is, maybe you could give us the general description of Jimmy Akin's mysterious world.
Sure. So it's an audio and video podcast where every week we look at a mysterious subject. The mysteries come in all different flavors. Some of them are scientific mysteries. Some of them are historical mysteries. Some of them relate to true crime. Some of them relate to the paranormal. UFOs and Bigfoot are in there, religious mysteries, all kinds of different mysteries. And we look at them from the twin perspectives of faith and reason. So after we give the background to the mystery and what's claimed about it, we then look at it and say, okay, what would reason tell us about this mystery? And then what would the faith tell us about this mystery? And unlike a lot of mystery shows, we don't just try to generate wonder in the audience and imagine what if. Instead, we actually try to solve the mysteries to the extent that that's possible.
You can find it at mysterious.fm. Check out mysterious.fm. And lots of families have found it a fun family activity. And among families and other listeners, it has become one of the most popular documentary podcasts in the United States. So check it out, mysterious.fm. Do you think that the type of questions you get on this show have been affected by the fact that you do Mysterious World?
Very definitely. There's some bleed through between the two shows. Here on Catholic Answers Live, we sometimes do weird question shows,
yeah,
where people ask deliberately weird questions. And then I use those for occasional episodes on Mysterious World. But then also Mysterious World listeners know I know about these areas. And so they ask questions of that nature on Catholic Answers Live, and we'll have a few of those today.
All right, I'm going to be tempted to give out the number, but I'm going to try to resist the temptation because it's an internet open forum. Lots and lots of great questions for Jimmy, and we'll start with Samantha's question. Samantha asks this, Jimmy: what are your thoughts on the prophecy of the angelic pope and the great Catholic monarch?
Okay, so first we should probably explain what these are. These are concepts that are reported to have been talked about by various Catholic visionaries a few centuries ago. The angelic pope was going to be a really good reformer pope who was going to, you know, make stuff in the church right, the way it ought to be. And the Catholic monarch was going to be a European leader who was a king, who was very powerful, and who was going to be a devout Catholic and really make stuff in the secular sphere in Europe run the way it ought to. So it's kind of a tag team, these two great figures, the angelic pope and the Catholic monarch. And, you know, at the time obviously we still have popes, but at the time that these prophecies were being given or reportedly given, there's always a question with some of these older things about, is this, you know, historically accurate that this person actually claimed this, mm-hmm. because a lot of times you don't see them citing primary sources. Monarchs were powerful in Europe, and so there, you know, it would be logical to think in terms of, if we're going to have a big reform in society and things are going to go back to the way they ought to be, then you would want a pope and a powerful monarch leading that effort. So that's kind of what these concepts are. And at least if you read modern documents that cover prophecies allegedly given, say, between the 1600s or the 1500s and the 1800s, you do find, you know, these claims. However, these claims are dependent on the idea of a strong monarchy. And that's no longer really part of European culture. There are countries like France that don't even have a monarch. There are other, and Germany, you know, neither of them has a king. There are other countries that do, like, you know, England, for example, and some of the Scandinavian countries, but their monarchs are weak by historical terms. They are not absolute monarchs, and they're not really running the show. They're kind of figureheads. They don't give orders that people have to follow in the great majority of circumstances. Instead, parliamentary government has become the norm. And there's even, on the continent these days, there's even a kind of super parliament for the European Union. And I don't foresee a return of powerful monarchies happening anytime soon. There'd have to be a massive cultural and political upheaval in Europe to see a resurgence of strong monarchies. And so I would tend to see these prophecies as having been disconfirmed by historical events, if they were given at all. I mean, I'm sure in some cases they were, but in other cases, a prophecy may have been falsely attributed to a seer. And so for those that were actually given, I would tend to view them as having been disconfirmed. Either that, or they date to an age that's in the far future that we can't really imagine at this point.
All right, Samantha, thanks for starting us off. Appreciate it. This one comes from Gene. Until the second coming, we won't have our bodies if we are in heaven, provided we get there, of course. How will we interact then with our loved ones who we hope are in heaven and we long to see again? What does that even look like? I believe the church does not have definitive teaching on this, but what has been the speculation?
Well, you're right. The church doesn't have a definitive teaching on this, but there is, I think, some pretty reliable speculation in this area. Since we won't have our bodies with us, but we do have evidence that we will be communicating, like, for example, we'll learn if we're in heaven about people on earth who want our prayers, and then we'll be able to pray to God on their behalf. That's the intercession of the saints. That communication would have to take place mind to mind, which would mean it's telepathic communication. Now, there are different ideas about how that telepathic communication might take place. For example, one view that was supported, for example, by St. Thomas Aquinas is that essentially between humans, that telepathy would all happen through God. So God is like a heavenly internet router that will take messages from earth, route them to the saints in heaven, and then the saints in heaven will pray to him and he'll have an effect on earth. And so God is mediating all of these messages, all of this comm traffic. On the other hand, we have some evidence from parapsychology of human-to-human telepathy here on earth. And if that's true, then God might be superintending the process the way he superintends everything in creation, but we might be directly telepathically messaging each other. And so God might not be serving as a heavenly internet router. In terms of how the afterlife is depicted, well, the book of Revelation depicts the new earth post resurrection as an environment where the saints live, and it's depicted as a glorious city with streets of gold. You know, that's where that you sometimes hear that image associated with heaven. Although what a lot of people forget is Revelation actually says the streets are transparent gold. Also, Revelation depicts the gates of this city. It says there are 12 gates, and they're made out of giant pearls, with like a gate carved into it, the giant pearl. And so that's where the pearly gates come from. So you can imagine these big spherical pearls with gates carved into them, city-sized gates. It's pretty well concluded by biblical scholars that these images are not meant to be taken literally, because the afterlife will actually exceed what we can imagine now. And so these are meant to give us a taste of what it's like, but they're not meant to be exactly what we're going to see. And this is also suggested by evidence from parapsychology. There are several death-related phenomena that the field studies, because it does study the survival of human consciousness after death. Some of these include what are known as deathbed visions, where someone is not yet dead, but they're like laying on their deathbed and they have a vision of, for example, angels or departed loved ones coming to them and saying, it's your time and we've come to get you and bring you to the next life. They also sometimes get glimpses of the next life. Same thing happens in what are known as near-death experiences, where someone either biologically dies or almost biologically dies, but sometimes they do, their heart will stop, and they perceive the same kind of stuff. They have angels or relatives coming to bring them to the next life. They get imagery from the next life. And then there are what are known as after-death communications, where someone has lost a loved one, and then spontaneously their loved one shows up one day, either in a dream or in waking life, and they say, hey, I wanted to let you know I'm okay here in the afterlife. Or sometimes they say, I need you to forgive me because I'm sorry for that stuff I did to you during life. And sometimes they get to see a glimpse of the afterlife where their departed loved one is. And in all of these experiences, in deathbed visions, in near-death experiences, and in after-death communications, when someone gets to see the afterlife, it's very beautiful, at least for 80% of people. This is not counting the people who have unpleasant experiences. But of the people who have pleasant experiences, they see a beautiful realm. It may be garden-like. It may be city-like. It may combine elements of like a garden, you know, kind of country, beautiful landscape with beautiful flowers and things like that, with little outposts of cities in it too. And so it's generally understood that, just like with the Book of Revelation, that these images are meant to give us a sense of what it's like, but we shouldn't take them overly literally.
Gene, what a great question. That brings us right to the break. It's an Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin this hour. Lots more questions to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
At EWTN Radio, you're family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205-795-5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and Jimmy gets a lot of questions from a lot of different sources, and sometimes we gather them up and we do an internet show, and all these questions come from the internet. We're calling it Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin today, and this one comes from Linda. Do you think there were Sasquatches on the Ark? Well, I lost Jimmy's audio, so I'm not. Did somebody mute Jimmy? Look, we're about to find out, Linda. But there's a conspiracy against speaking openly about Sasquatches. Apparently, I don't have audio from Jimmy, so we're not exactly sure why we lost audio. All right, I'll tell you what. I'll do the ad while we're waiting to see if they can figure out what's going on with the audio. Check out all the great deals over at shop.catholic.com. For a long time, shop.catholic.com has been our bookstore where you could buy Catholic Answers books and materials, but it has expanded. You can buy everything from books and materials as we used to do to clothing, hats, sweatshirts, all that stuff. Check it out at shop.catholic.com. Jimmy, do you think there were Sasquatches on the Ark? Well, well, we still got an audio. They're checking the cables. They're literally checking the cables in there. We are not sure why we lost audio, but it's coming. They'll work it out. They'll figure it out in a second. I almost gave out the number, but I can't give out the number because it's an internet Ask Me Anything today. We used to call these open forum. Now we call them Ask Me Anything because that's what the world decided to do. The world decided to have these Ask Me Anything episodes on Reddit and around the internet. And since that's what young people, that's the moniker young people understand these things by, we decided, yeah, let's do that. Let's just call it Ask Me Anything because there's a wider audience that knows what that is than knows what open forum is. So if you used to love listening to open forum, it's the same thing. It's just called Ask Me Anything, Catholic edition, or Ask Me Anything, whatever our particular topic that we want to cover with that person that day is. Usually I give out the number at this point, but I am not going to give out the number because all of our questions are coming from the internet today. It's an internet Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And I'll tell you what I'll do. One other thing I'll do while we're waiting to see if they can get that microphone straightened out with Jimmy is I will invite you to come to the Catholic Answers Conference. We do it each September, the last weekend of September, right here in sunny San Diego. About 1,000 people come over the course of the weekend, and we have a great time. It's got a little bit of a summer camp, apologetic summer camp feel to it, but it's a very nice summer camp because we do it at the Hyatt right here in La Jolla. So you can check out that at CatholicAnswersConference.com. Just check out CatholicAnswersConference.com, and you can come. And you can check out all that we do at Catholic.com. Of course, if there's materials that, anything that you'd like, virtually any question you'd like answered about the Catholic faith is answered over at Catholic.com. It's the second most popular Catholic website. The second most popular Catholic URL in the world. The first belongs to the Pope. So, I mean, that's tough competition. We'll take second place to the Pope anytime. We'll take second place if first place is occupied by the Pope. But what we hear all the time from people, from pastors, from RCIA directors, from people who work in apologetics or
one,
Catholic
two,
schools,
three.
Jimmy counted. Well, that means I can hear him. All right, I'll just go back to the questions. Check out Catholic.com for all your Catholic questions. Jimmy, do you think there were Sasquatches on the Ark?
Well, if you assume that Sasquatches are real, and if you assume that the Great Flood was a global flood so that the only creatures that survived were on the Ark, then yeah, I would say Sasquatches were absolutely on the Ark. But that's making those two assumptions. So, there are other alternatives besides Sasquatches exist and besides the Great Flood was a global flood. If you want to hear about those, you can actually listen to a few episodes of Mysterious World. I did a two-part look at the Great Flood in episodes 175 and 176. So you can go to mysterious.fm/175 and mysterious.fm/176 to hear about the Great Flood and what science and reason would, what faith and reason would say about it. I also did Bigfoot way back at the beginning of the show in episode 3, which is at mysterious.fm/3. But I would say that I have been reconsidering my views on the subject. At the time, I said that it's very unlikely that a large primate exists in North America without having been discovered by modern science because of all the eyeballs and cameras and people looking for it. However, I've since doing that episode 5 years ago, I've come across additional evidence that is making me reconsider that. I'm not at a point of saying I think Bigfoot or Sasquatch is real, but there's more evidence than I was aware of at the time, and so I'm not as confident of that view.
Oh, so we might get a revisiting of the whole Sasquatch question.
Yes.
Oh, very good.
That's the plan.
Well, Linda, we made you wait for your answer, but thank you very much for the question. It's an internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Eric wanted to know this, Jimmy. We say the Trinity is three persons. I've been told on inquiry that these are not three selves as we would normally understand persons. But I'm also told that the Holy Spirit is the love between the Father and the Son, and that the Holy Trinity is a community, but only distinct selves can love each other or be in community. Both of these, if it's, it seems to me, cannot be true. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, and I think part of the issue here is Eric is encountering people using terminology that does not have a precise theological definition. There is a precise theological definition for person. This term, the classic definition was given by the philosopher Boethius, who lived back in the, say, 500s, and he defined a person as an independent substance with a rational nature. But self does not have a precise theological definition. I would be very hesitant to use language that suggests the three persons of the Trinity are not selves, as we would normally understand the term. The three persons of the Trinity obviously transcend the kind of person that we are. You know, they transcend us. In fact, they are the prototype of for all finite persons. You know, God is three persons from eternity. These are infinite persons that share a divine nature, and we're kind of cheap knockoffs. So God, God is the prototype of persons compared to us. And I would tend to say, since selfhood is associated with personhood, I would tend to say that the three persons are also the prototype selves. I would say, if you simply say that the persons are not, that they're not persons or selves, the way we understand the term, then it would communicate a false idea to the listener that would somehow suggest that they're less than persons. It would depersonalize them to say, well, they're not persons or they're not selves the way we think of persons or selves. People would tend to make the mistake of thinking they're less than a person instead of, oh, they're the original prototype persons or selves. So I think that careful work would have to be done to avoid a conclusion like that. In the case of the Holy Spirit being the love of the Father and the Son, this is analogous. That is church teaching. And it's analogous to how the Son is the Word of the Father. You know, well, love here in our realm, which is less than the divine realm, love is not a person. It's something abstract. And in the same way, words are not persons. They're something more abstract. But on the divine level, the reality of personhood is so great that the Word of the Father is another person. So the Word on the divine level is a person. And in the same way, the reality of personhood on the divine level is so great that the love between the Father and the Son is also a person. And so the three persons of the Trinity are not less than persons. They're not impersonal. They're more than we are. And that's why the Word and the love on the divine level are actually distinct persons in addition to the Father.
Eric, thank you very much. The great mystery of our faith. Appreciate the question. It's an internet. We've got internet questions for Jimmy today, and internet, ask me anything. This one comes from Ryan. Is there any equivalent to Eucharistic adoration for the precious blood? If so, why? If not, why not?
So the law requires that the precious blood be reserved only when it is going to be taken to someone who is sick. This presumably would be a sick person who can't receive communion in the form of the host. You know, that's why they need to receive the precious blood. When the precious blood is reserved, it must be placed in a sealed container in the tabernacle to prevent it from being accidentally spilled. Consequently, there is no equivalent to Eucharistic exposition for the precious blood, at least not in the Latin rite. However, exposition, which is where you put it out for people to view and adore, exposition is not the only kind of Eucharistic adoration. And consequently, if the precious blood has been reserved so that it can be taken to a sick person, one could still adore the precious blood even though it's in the tabernacle. It's not exposed, but reposed in the tabernacle. And even if it hasn't been adored, one can still adore the precious blood in the host, because Christ's body and blood are united. So his blood is in the host as well as his body. And whether the host is reserved or exposed, you could adore the precious blood within it.
All right. That's going to bring us just about to the break. So Ryan will say thank you very much for the question. Lots more questions to come. Perhaps some Sasquatches, UFOs, aliens, demons, all the things that you find on, or some of the things that you find on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World will be among those. I do know that there's lots of great questions to come. So hang on. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ, September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast, visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We are only a fraction of the way through all these awesome questions that we've got. So lots more fun to have. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Of course, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World that you can find more than 300 episodes of at mysterious.fm and new episodes each Friday morning. If you've got a question for Jimmy, you can also call us. Many days Jimmy's here with us, but sometimes people send the questions via the internet, and so it's an internet ask me anything. Today, David asks this, what's the difference between feasting and gluttony?
Okay, feasting occurs when one eats more than normal in order to celebrate something special. Gluttony occurs when one eats a sufficient quantity of food, either in one sitting or over a period of time, to endanger one's health. So there can be overlap between feasting and gluttony, but they are not the same thing. Sometimes one can feast without committing gluttony. Sometimes one can commit gluttony and feasting at the same time. Sometimes one can commit gluttony without feasting. The difference is that feasting involves more food than normal, and gluttony involves enough food to damage your health.
Yeah.
So that's the distinction. I happen to watch there's a YouTube channel I follow called Beard Meets Food. It's about this guy from England who is a competitive eater, and he goes around to different restaurants and tries their food challenges, you know, because different restaurants will have like, if you can eat this, you know, 3 foot wide pizza by yourself in an hour, it's free and we'll give you a t-shirt. You know, so restaurants will have different food challenges. And so every week, Beard Meets Food goes to different restaurants around the world and takes on their food challenges. And he normally succeeds, and he normally eats a very considerable amount of food. I watched him eat recently. His most recent one at the time of recording was a lobster roll, which is a kind of lobster meat sandwich.
Yeah.
And French fries that together weighed 8 pounds. So the lobster roll itself weighed 6 pounds. And then he had 1.5 pounds of fries and 1 pound of coleslaw. And so he ate 8 pounds of food in one sitting, and which is amazing. But he is not committing gluttony, because he fasts in between when he takes on the food challenges. So he's actually a pretty thin guy. So he's not eating enough to damage his health. That's what makes it gluttony. If you eat enough to damage your health, that's essentially what gluttony is.
Oh, well, thank you for the question. Beard Meets Food.
At least in a modern context. Historically, if you ate so much that, I mean, you could commit gluttony in other ways too. Like, let's suppose your family has a limited food budget and you just pig out and eat food that takes food out of the mouths of your wife and children. Well, then that would be gluttony too. Gluttony is eating enough food that it causes harm either to yourself or to others.
David, thank you for the question. This one comes from Stephanie. Someone with the surname of Murray said the name meant they are descended from Mary after she moved to France. I don't so pardon my French, but WTH question mark. What is
it? Yes. So the claim is that the surname Murray comes from Mary, and that Mary, the Virgin Mary, at some point moved to France, and that's what led to the name. Okay, well, this is a folk etymology, as they're known in linguistics, which is just an idea that people have come up with. It's not rigorously documented. And like a lot of folk etymologies, it's really problematic. In the first place, Murray is not a French name. Murray is a Scottish and Irish name, and we know where it comes from. This is where a lot of folk etymology stumble, is linguists, and specifically etymologists, can go into the historical record and see how the name developed. And in the Scottish version of the name, it developed from Moray. Moray being derived from Gaelic roots that mean sea settlement. So if you came from the sea settlement, you came from the Moray, and your last name became Murray. Some versions of the Irish version reportedly mean things like descendant of the servant of Mary, which would be a title of religious devotion. You know, one of your ancestors considered themselves a servant of Mary, and so you get the name Murray that way. But we have no good evidence of Mary coming to France.
All right. When I was reading it, I was thinking maybe Mary Magdalene, because that's the one that sometimes you hear the legend of, Mary Magdalene came to France.
Well,
but anyway.
Same thing applies to Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
No good evidence of that happening.
Stephanie, thank you very much for the question. Trey asks this, make or dismiss the case that after the resurrection, Jesus appeared to Mother Mary first and in private.
So the only reliable accounts that we have of who Jesus appeared to after the resurrection are found in the four Gospels and the book of Acts and 1 Corinthians 15. None of these sources mention Jesus appearing first to his mother. Therefore, we have no good evidence that such an event happened. It's possible that it did, and I can understand how pious sentiment might lead someone to propose that it did, but we don't have good evidence that it did.
All right. Thank you very much, Trey. Let's go to Robert's question. What's a good book that talks about how the apostles died rather than denying the resurrection? Oh, I see.
Well,
he wants to know that they were martyred. Like, what's the evidence that they were martyrs, essentially?
Yeah, so this is a subject that comes up in a lot of apologetics books about the resurrection. Yeah. And there have been a number of good ones recently. There is, however, a book that is specifically on the question of what happened to the apostles that is of a scholarly nature. And so this is the book that I'd recommend if you really want to dig into the subject. It's called The Fate of the Apostles, and it's by Sean McDowell. And it's the best treatment of what happened to them as far as the historical record is concerned. You should know going in, though. Now, sometimes apologists get a little excited and overclaim a little bit. And they'll say, like, all of the apostles died martyrs' deaths except for John. And there are two problems with that. First, there are traditions that John also died a martyr's death. And second, we really don't know what happened to quite a number of the 12. We know what happened to some of them in considerable detail, like we know about what happened to Peter and Paul. But others, you know, we're not so sure. We have an idea of where they went, you know, like Thomas evangelized in India and so forth. We have pretty good evidence for that. But we don't have detailed, accurate records of their deaths. And so one of the things you find out when you read The Fate of the Apostles is, you know, we got to be a little bit moderate in what we claim about this. What we can claim is with high confidence is that they definitely suffered in life rather than deny the resurrection. We see that happening just in the book of Acts, you know, mm-hmm. And in 2 Corinthians, Paul has a list of all these things that he suffered on account of his ministry. You know, he gets stoned and he gets beaten with rods and he gets shipwrecked and he says, this happened to me this many times and this happened to me this many times, and all that's by AD, you know, 53 when 2 Corinthians was written. And Acts similarly records persecutions of the apostles for preaching the word. So we can say with very high confidence that they suffered on account of their message of the resurrection. And some of them did die because of their preaching the resurrection. But we can't say that all of them or all of them but John did.
All right. Thanks very much for the question, Trey. Jimmy, I just had my own question as you were talking. Have you ever published like in a chart form when the books of the New Testament were written? I know you've written about it, but I've never seen like a, you know what I mean? Like a little chart that could say this one was this year, this one was this year.
I think I have that or something like that in The Bible is a Catholic Book.
Oh, okay. All right, I got that.
And
right
I've also written blog posts about the dating of various books, and I have unpublished writings that I hope to complete and publish one day. As you know, I'm a biblical chronology nerd, and so I study biblical chronology in detail, and I've written a sizable chunk of a book on biblical chronology that would push it into new areas that I haven't seen anybody else do yet.
Like figuring out the
approximate dates of when things in the book of Acts happened, because Luke gives us bunches of chronological clues. And then how to fit those with Paul's epistles. And so I've got a lot of really interesting stuff that I just haven't completed and published yet, but hopefully one day.
Oh, very good. Very good. All right. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
EWTN offers listeners and viewers the daily readings to enable you to accompany the Mass of the day. Our Catholic daily readings include the readings of the day, along with online videos. It's a great resource for all who desire to live a life of faith that is pleasing to our Lord. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Lots of questions from the internet for Jimmy Akin this hour. It's an internet ask me anything. Jimmy Karen wants to know this. Okay, Jimmy, I have a weird one for you.
Well, we'll see how weird it is.
That's the way I always feel. Whenever anyone says, Jimmy, I have a weird question for you, I think, have you listened to Jimmy Akin? Like, this better be weird because he gets some really weird stuff. All right. I just hope I get a chance to hear your answer. What's all this about red heifers being prepared for slaughter in Israel as fulfillment of a prophecy?
Okay, so this is something that comes up in the news periodically because of an organization in Israel known as the Temple Institute, which is based in Jerusalem. The Temple Institute is a Jewish organization that is wanting to actively prepare for a restoration of the Jewish temple with a restoration of animal sacrifices. And this is a controversial position in Judaism. There is, in many branches of Judaism, a belief that there will be a future third temple. But there are some controversies about it. According to some Jews, there will be a future third temple in Jerusalem, but only God gets to build it. It's not going to be built by human hands. Or, according to others, it can only be rebuilt by the Messiah. So you've got to wait until the Messiah shows up before the temple will be rebuilt. And then others would say, nah, you don't got to wait for God or the Messiah. You can just go ahead and do it. But there's a problem with that because the Jewish Temple Mount is where the Dome of the Rock is. And the Dome of the Rock is a big, important shrine in Islam. And it would cause a massive, massive war that could threaten the existence of Israel if you tried to rebuild the temple on the Temple Mount where the Dome of the Rock is. Now, there have been some proposals of, well, maybe we could build it slightly adjacent and it wouldn't involve interfering with the Dome of the Rock, but that's not going to, there are other people who are going to say, no, we got to build it right where the Dome of the Rock is. Also, in addition to the problems with rebuilding it, there's also a current in a lot of Judaism that says, you know, we don't really want animal sacrifices back. You know, having a temple where we can worship God, that's one thing. That would be a good thing. But we don't really want to be, you know, slaughtering bulls and goats and sheep and pigeons and stuff like that and sprinkling their blood and taking their entrails and doing stuff. So not all Jews are sold on the idea of restoring animal sacrifices. But The Temple Institute is, and so they've been doing various things like preparing the special garments that Jewish priests are supposed to wear and preparing other liturgical articles that would be used in the temple, like a menorah and things like that. And one of the rituals that's described in the Old Testament does involve what's known as a red heifer, although in Hebrew it says the red cow. This ritual is found in Numbers 19, and basically you take a blemishless, so it's got no faults, you take a blemishless red heifer, a heifer being a young female cow that has not given birth or been worked, according to Numbers 19. So you take this young heifer, and you sacrifice it, and then you burn it, and you take its ashes, and you mix them with water, and then you can use the, and some other stuff, and then you can use this water as a rite of purification, particularly for the impurity, the ritual impurity that an Israelite would incur from coming into contact with a corpse. So like you, let's say you're a hospital worker, somebody dies, you've got to handle the body and you're now ritually impure. Well, you could go and use this water to purify yourself. Okay. So in evangelicalism, in Christianity, there is big belief in many evangelical circles that there will be a third temple and that the rebuilding of the third temple will be associated with the end times, with the second coming of Christ, things like that. And so evangelicals have been very interested in the Temple Institute and what it's trying to do. And And so periodically, the Temple Institute has been looking for red heifers that could potentially be used. And they found a number of candidates over the course of time. Some of them have been dismissed once the rabbis got a chance to look at them and said, eh, it's actually not what we're looking for. It's got, you know, it's got this minor ding here. It's got a little blemish.
Uh-huh.
But they continue to look for them. And because of interest in all of this in evangelical circles, it pops up in the Christian news sometimes.
Ah, all right, Karen, thank you very much. I don't know how weird it was, but it sure was interesting. Appreciate the question. This one comes from...
I read a book recently by a few months ago by a British researcher called High Strangeness.
Yeah.
And his name is Jack Hunter. He's actually a parapsychologist, and he works a lot in a field known as paraanthropology, which is the application of parapsychology to anthropology. And his book is like called High Weirdness or High Strangeness. I forget which one. And I read it and I thought, yeah, it's not that weird. I've seen a lot weirder.
It's pretty hard to out weird Jimmy Akin. I like the idea of just walking around the heifer load like you're walking around a rental car looking for dings or bumps or something like that. Karen, thank you for the question. This one comes from Jenna. Please give your feedback on this statement. Receiving on the tongue is the default option.
Well, that used to be the case in the Latin Rite. For a long time in the Latin Rite, the laity only received communion on the tongue. And so that was the default. Then, following the Second Vatican Council, an indult, meaning a permission, was given to also receive in the hand. And under that scheme, it would still be that the default is you receive on the tongue, but you're also permitted to receive on the hand. But now we're in a third stage where, according to the general instruction of the Roman Missal, this is Germ 160, if you want to look it up, the consecrated host may be received either on the tongue or in the hand at the discretion of each communicant. So the way the law is currently phrased, it doesn't establish a preference for either one. We're no longer in the period where there was an indult to receive in the hand. Instead, the law has now put them on the same level. Now, I personally always receive on the tongue, but that's a matter of my own personal piety. In terms of what the law says, the law puts them on an equal footing in the Latin Rite, and it leaves which option you want to exercise up to the individual communicant's discretion.
Thank you, Jenna. Hey, David, thank you for this. I'm looking forward to finding out what the answer is. What really is sleep? David asks.
Well, sleep is a biological state that, with variations, appears to characterize all life forms. So it's not just humans, it's not just mammals like dogs and cats, it's not just birds or reptiles. Fish seem to sleep. Insects seem to sleep. Even microbes, you know, subatomic creatures, go through these periods of less activity than where they're in a kind of what's known as torpor. That is apparently their version of sleep. So sleep appears to characterize all known life forms. It involves lower levels of physical and mental activity, at least for those creatures that have what you could think of as a mind. So our bodies become less mobile, our minds become less active, and in mammals, birds, and reptiles, we have evidence for dreaming, and that would suggest that either dreaming is really useful because that it evolved multiple times in different branches of the tree of life, or more likely it evolved once about 360 million years ago when the last common ancestor between those branches would have existed, and it's been so useful that evolution has kept it around. There's some kind of selection pressure on the genes that cause dreaming. The purpose of sleep is not fully understood at this point. However, it appears to involve resetting biological processes, you know, like getting rid of fatigue toxins and stuff like that, so you wake up fresh. It also may involve the repair of the body, You know, your body may be able to fix itself in this low activity state in a way it can't if you're up and moving around. It also may involve the regulation of the immune system so that it helps protect us against diseases. And dreaming, for those creatures that have it, may possibly involve the consolidation and clearing of memory. So all of those are possibilities, but if you want to know more, I did an episode of Mysterious World on the mystery of sleep, and it's episode 98. So that would be mysterious.fm/98.
David, thank you for that interesting question. This one comes from Kevin. What does the church state about forcing men to take psychological exams before being accepted to seminary?
Well, canon law provides that before ordination, the priest, the bishop must have moral certainty that the candidate for ordination has the right psychological qualities for ministry. But it does not mandate, so this is the code of canon law itself, does not mandate that psychological exams be taken prior to seminary. So since the code of canon law doesn't say it, it's not part of universal law, at least in the code. So any regulations pertaining to this are going to be either in particular law or in some kind, meaning the law of a particular territory, or they're going to be in something other than the code. Now, I would say it's not unreasonable to do some kind of psychological testing before you admit someone to seminary, because if the person is not going to be suitable, I mean, seminary takes, you know, years. And if someone's not going to be suitable in the end, then it's going to waste your time and your money and a lot of frustration on the part, not just of the church officials, but also on the part of the person who's going to seminary. So if it could be determined ahead of time whether or not a candidate is a good fit psychologically for the ministry, then it would make sense to do it before you admit them to seminary. And since the sex abuse crisis broke out, there has been a greater emphasis on pre-seminary screening of candidates. So you don't have guys that get, who are not suitable, who get all the way through the program, and then it's hard to say, no, sorry, last minute you don't get ordained after you invested 5 years preparing for this. So it does make some sense to have some pre-seminary screening incorporating psychological testing. Key documents to read in this include a Vatican document that is called Guidelines for the Use of Psychology in the admission and formation of candidates for the priesthood. So that's Guidelines for the Use of Psychology in the administration and formation of candidates to the priesthood. There's also a United States Catholic Conference of Catholic Bishops document called Guidelines for the Use of Psychology in Seminary Admissions. And then there's also a USCCB document called Program for Priestly Formation, which is currently in its sixth edition. And so those are three documents I'd point Kevin towards if he wants to read more about this and the details of what the regulations here in the United States are in this regard. I would also say, though, that there's a big caveat here, because psychology is not one of the physical sciences, and like all science, it continuously develops, and it's often termed, it these days, the polite way to say it is it's a social science, but historically the way it's been said is it is a soft science, meaning it depends a lot on interpretation, and a lot of psychological tests aren't really very good. For example, the MMPI, or Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, it doesn't really tell you very much. And so there can be a tendency to attribute too much significance to the psychological tests we have available to us now.
Kevin, thank you for the question. Lots more questions to come. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an internet Ask Me Anything. We've gathered up lots of questions that have come via the internet to Jimmy, and we got them all lined up and ready to go. Some of them weird, some of them just interesting. We'll get to all that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.